Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Cystic fibrosis is a common genetic disease, relatively speaking. About one in every 25 to 30 Caucasians are carriers of one or more of the 1,700 mutations that can cause cystic fibrosis. Researchers and companies working on cystic fibrosis treatments are increasingly paying attention to which mutations a patient carries and tailoring drugs to certain mutations. In fact, just recently, the FDA expanded its approval for one CF drug, Kalydeco, from 10 mutations to 33. And they did it without a full clinical trial. Joining me now to talk through the significance of this development is Art Kaplan. He's professor of bioethics at New York University's Langone Medical Center. He founded the center's Division of Biomedical Ethics. Art, always good to talk with you.
Thank you for having me.
All right. This expanded approval of the cystic fibrosis drug Kalydeco is significant because it helps more patients, of course, but also because the approval didn't involve a full-blown clinical trial. So what was the basis for the approval?
So normally in approving a drug or the expansion of a drug for a broader purpose or to cover more people, you would have to go through phase one testing, healthy volunteers, phase two testing, trying to figure out what doses to use, and then what most people think of as the clinical trial, which is that randomized trial, probably in hundreds of people, with either a control arm that's a placebo or measuring it against the existing treatments. That didn't happen here, and it didn't happen because the mutations, I think you said there were more than 1,000.
More than 1,700.
Yeah. So they're too rare to have hundreds and hundreds of people in a trial. You just can't do it. And as we begin to understand the genetics of disease, whether it's breast cancer, prostate cancer, muscular dystrophy, whatever it's going to be, we're starting to learn that tiny genetic differences make a difference either to the existence of the disease or to how severe it is. So they just don't have enough people to do the standard model of testing. So they agreed to go forward because they thought the mutations that they extended this out to, the genetic changes, were close enough, common enough to where they'd seen efficacy to let the drug be tested in a slightly bigger group of people. But it's not a huge number more, and they'll be watching it very closely to see whether anything is effective or whether there are safety issues. But it is sending a signal in the future. Some of the things we usually saw, a randomized trial with hundreds, if not thousands of subjects, they're not going to work because of the ability to pick out genetic differences among subjects, making it harder to do the big studies.
A few months ago, we spoke with the father of a child with a deadly cancer, neuroblastoma, and he had been working with researchers and with the FDA to get a treatment for that cancer approved, again, without a full clinical trial, with slightly different data. Do you think this is a growing trend because of the different kinds of data that we now have available to us that we might not have had 10, 20, 30 years ago, that we are starting to see more of these perhaps unorthodox approvals by the FDA?
I do, and I think they're going to start to become orthodox rather than unorthodox. In the old days, we tried to develop drugs that were one size fits all. Whatever the condition, if you were diagnosed as having lupus or depression or whatever, you got the same drug that everybody else in that disease group got. Now, we start to see that there are genetic differences among people with these diseases. And that tells us a little bit why some people have really horrible allergies, some people have mild allergies, some people have very aggressive cancers. Say for prostate cancer, some move very slowly. In any event, the way we've organized trials in the past has to start to take into account this genetic variability. And then we have another issue, which is what you're talking about with this terrible brain tumors. Some of them are just rare. They're so rare that if you said you can't get a drug approved without a clinical trial, well, then you'd never get anything approved because maybe, you know, one in 50,000 people get this disease or even fewer. How are you going to approve drugs if you say, well, you have to have a trial that's tested on hundreds and hundreds of people when they're just not there?
it also seems that perhaps with a disease like the neuroblastoma, that it can be so deadly in children when it reoccurs, or in, you know, recent days with Ebola and the possibility of a vaccine, where the risks of the disease are so great. Maybe we're recalculating and coming up with a different answer about what risks are worth taking.
Well, there's a couple of points we made. The first one is a lot of patients or families will say they agree with you. Look, if I have a deadly disease like neuroblastoma, it's going to kill me for sure. Then the risk-benefit calculation becomes almost silly. I'll try almost anything to see what I could do to fight this disease. Similarly with Ebola, very fatal. You know, if you have a new drug or a new vaccine, try it on me. So the risk-benefit ratio is shifting, not just because the terminally ill or the very ill are willing to take risk, but we now have happily more drugs and vaccines to try to use against those conditions. So that's good. It means the FDA, again, has to rethink its policies, but so do the manufacturers. At the end of the day, if I want to try a drug, it isn't the FDA that really says you can or you can't. It's the company that makes the drug. They have to agree to give it to me or not. Only if they do would the FDA get involved to just make sure it's safe. And by the way, this is called expanded access. The FDA approves 99% of that kind of a request. So they're not really in the way. It's the question is, will the drug manufacturer who owns the drug and maybe wants to get paid for the drug, give it to the family that has the kid with a neuroblastoma or the very poor person in Liberia who has Ebola?
You know, that rate, that very high rate of the FDA approving requests in the case of terminal diseases, that sort of thing. And now this trend of more approvals without full clinical trials seems like, as you were saying, a good thing that we're getting medicines to more people. But it sounded like in your voice, there was a big but lurking there somewhere. Is there a drawback to approving drugs without a full clinical trial?
Yeah, you're right in picking up the but that I have, the hesitancy. It's not that I wouldn't do this. I would. However, we need a system that makes it possible for people to gain access. Some states have passed laws called right to try laws, which say anybody should be able to get anything without worrying about the FDA. Well, those laws are stupid, silly, and wrong because the FDA isn't in the way. As I told you, the FDA will give approval. It's up to the manufacturer. So let's say there's a drug available in Seattle and someone in Falmouth wants to use it. Well, how are they getting to Seattle? Who's paying the babysitter? And what if the company out in Seattle says, yeah, we'll give you the drug, but it cost us $500,000 to make it. It's going to cost you $100,000 to get it. For all the talk about helping people gain access and all these laws that some states are passing to sort of believe that they're facilitating that, we haven't budgeted any money to help these families, these patients, get access to what they need. So that's really a problem. The other big problem is we should be studying what happens to these patients. You know, we give the drugs, but we don't necessarily get reports on what happened. So I think minimally, you do want to get some information back. Did it help? Did it hurt? Did they die faster? Were they made very sick? So just giving drugs out to the family and their doctor and not requiring reports back, I think that's not the way to go.
You also mentioned right at the outset, you know, this new Kalydeco expanded approval increases the number of mutations that it covers from 10 to 33. That's actually a relatively small increase in the number of cystic fibrosis patients that will benefit from this. And in fact, we spoke several months ago with a local woman who has a rare and relatively mild cystic fibrosis mutation. She's not included in this expanded approval. And I wonder if there's kind of a double-edged sword to this genetic information when we can tailor diseases down to one specific mutation. Is there the potential to exclude patients who don't have that mutation but might benefit from the drug?
One of the problems is that these newer drugs, they're called sometimes precision medicine. Listeners may have heard references to targeted therapies. Sometimes advertisements are around that tout this stuff. We also hear terms like immunotherapy, which means a particular drug that triggers our immune system to go after cancer cells, a new trick that we've been seeing come into medicine. These are all great, but they do create both the recognition that not every drug is going to work on every form of the disease, because some of them only attack certain chemicals that the person with the disease has that are causing the symptoms. And there's no point in giving you the drug if we know it doesn't target the right bad chemicals that are causing, say, symptoms of cystic fibrosis. So it's not so much that you wouldn't give it. It's just that you start to understand that with this precision targeted stuff, unless the chemical is there that this drug goes after, there's no reason. Other people are going to say, well, I have to wait because you're only going to test it in the more severe disease types before you get to my mild type. That's true. That's going slowly. That is how you roll out drugs. There's going to be some squawking about that. But I think, again, if you want to ensure safety, you probably have to proceed with some caution before you say, I've got this drug for cystic fibrosis and I'm going to give it to every single person who's got mild, moderate, or severe disease. You don't want to kill somebody prematurely who only had mild cystic fibrosis, who was doing fairly well with the existing treatments.
Around the same time as the Kalydeco expanded approval announcement, the FDA also announced the first approval of a cancer drug that can be used to treat cancers with a certain mutation regardless of where the cancer shows up in the body. So not for breast cancer, not for colorectal cancer, but for any cancer with a particular mutation. How fundamental a shift is that?
It is huge, and it is the future. So think about it this way. We used to think of cancer as one disease. Back in the 50s, people said, oh, you got cancer. Breast, prostate, lung, melanoma, all cancer. Now we know that isn't true. Different cancers have different biological makeup to the cancer cells. So we know now that rather than treat cancer, what we want to do is look for chemicals in the cancer cells that we can attack. It doesn't really matter whether it's a stomach cancer, a breast cancer, a skin cancer, testicular cancer. If the particular target is there in the cancer cells, then they all could be treated with the same drug, even if the disease is appearing in many different parts of the body. But I'll go further. Some diseases that we don't even think of as related, let's say ALS, muscular dystrophy, and severe depression, they may turn out to have the same chemical pathway that you can block with a drug. So the reason I said this change is big is that it starts to make us rethink what we call diseases. We used to classify them by symptoms, maybe by the pathology, the cells growing in the same way, and we'd say, well, that's the same disease. Now we're going to start to say, hey, I've got this drug. It attacks a particular protein or chemical. It doesn't matter whether it's a headache or cancer. If that protein is there, this drug might help. And so we're going to see ourselves reclassifying what is the same disease.
When the Human Genome Project was happening and in the immediate aftermath, going back 15 or so years, there was a lot of hype about the promise of having this genetic information. And then after that, there was a period of some letdown and people kind of asking, well, where is all of that amazing precision genetic medicine that we were promised out of the Human Genome Project? Are we starting now to finally see the benefits of the Human Genome Project?
Well, remember, we announced that we had mapped the human genome, figured out all its constituent parts of our genes in 1998. So 20 years later, we're starting to see the first efforts to use that information in diagnosis and in therapy. You might call that pretty good hype, from announcing the mapping to 20 years later starting to get application. So we are starting to get it. It just turned out that basically mapping the genome turned on a fire hose of information. It took a very long time to get all the little variations and differences between people, both that are due to ethnicity or history, how often you've been in the sun and how much damage that's doing to your skin cells, to start to nail that down. I think some of it was hype and some of it was optimism way back in the 90s when we mapped the genome. But there is a lesson there. It isn't just getting the crude map done. Think about driving around Cape Cod. If you just had a rough map of the dunes and, you know, major geological features, rivers, whatnot, you couldn't get very far. You need a street map. What we're seeing now is the development of the street map with landmarks, houses defined. You can see where the shopping centers are. You can see where the roads and the side roads are. That's why we're starting to get the cures now.
It's the Google Maps of the human genome. Bioethicist Art Kaplan of New York University's Langone Medical Center. Thanks so much. It's always a pleasure.
Hey, my pleasure.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. You can always find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone and Elsa Partan. Mindy Todd is the executive producer. Major support for Living Lab comes from the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw and the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation.